Let's call to order the regular meeting of the North Bend Planning Commission for Thursday, February 22nd, 2018. First item of business is called roll. No, I won't start with you. Commissioner Ryan.
Get Ryan present.
Commissioner Gildersleeve.
Present.
Mr. Lucky.
Yes.
Mr. Miller.
Here.
Mr. Redding.
Yeah. Contract.
Contract.
Present.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nickname Mr. Ready.
Mr. Ready.
So we do have a quorum present. I'd like to welcome our arborist Jim Barberinas, is that correct?
Right.
And senior planner Jamie Burrell to our meeting. Next item of business is to approve this evening's agenda. Do I have a motion?
So
moved. Well, okay. Motion by Commissioner Gildersleeve and a second. Second by Commissioner Von Trapp. Any comments or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor of tonight's agenda, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Agenda is approved. Next item of business is to approve the minutes for February 8th, 2018. Is there a motion? And a second? Okay, we have a motion by Commissioner Miller, second by Commissioner Lucky. Any comments or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes for February 8th, please say aye.
Aye.
Minutes are approved. It is unanimous. Next item on the agenda is public comment on non-agenda items. Is there any member of the public that wishes to address the commission on something that is not on tonight's agenda?
Mr. Chair, nothing. No comments on non-agenda items. The commission allowed, I think, a brief comment on tonight's agenda.
Anybody object? Okay. If you're ready now, please rise and state your name and address for the record.
Rob McFarland, 1036 Maloney Grove Avenue Southeast, which is a I know you're about to take up a proposed revision to the tree retention amendments, and I'm going to preface briefly by saying, you know, I have a degree in natural resources and environmental education. I've spent the better part of my life in the outdoors and family farming. I've got a great affinity for nature and trees and everything related to it. And we have the fortune to be blessed here in the valley by being surrounded by thousands and thousands of acres of forest with millions of trees around us. And we're also blessed that we have a Growth Management Act which directs density into existing urban areas in our rural city so that we can maintain those trees out there in the forest. I've also been involved in land development, as most of you know, for about 20 years. And I always view the give and take on regulations between the developer and city's best interest as, you know, a scale that kind of goes back and forth in a fairly narrow band, and it all works out. I would describe this proposal as being so far out of the realm of reason that it's astounding to me. I actually see it as perhaps the worst piece of legislation I've ever seen come before this committee. Certainly in all the time that I served on it, in the time that I worked with the commission beforehand and since. And that's all I'll say for the evening. I know you've got a lot of work ahead of you. Jim and I have a lot of history back in many days as well, so you'll certainly get both sides strongly. And I would ask to Jamie if it could be appropriate if you sent me the word version of the red line. I'll provide comments back section by section to make it easier for you to read since I write to it. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else from the public that wishes to make a comment to the Planning Commission?
I'm so sorry I missed that. I wish I would have caught that. Joe Eddings, address is 43438 Southeast North Bend Lane, North Bend, and I'm curious to hear more about this to have understand this, what's going on with the city, so I'm kind of curious as well. But kind of off topic, the two things that I want to bring to attention of the community is I've been going through the new revision of the uses and permitted uses, and zoning changes, and middle of business, and EP1, and getting rid of EP1, or so I'm trying to keep up with everything. I've been so busy with other stuff, so it's real hard, so I'm going to give snippets of things. But the one thing I got to say that I've been very vocal on is how you guys totally redlined the towing business. I have no relations to anybody in the towing business. I don't have any connections with them. I have no financial. I'm just saying, I think that's such a needed service here. For you guys to take that and just yank that carpet off from a service that really provides a great service for the community. I've used them numerous times. I own the car wash down so far. I can't tell me a time these guys can be there in 5 minutes. Somebody's stuck in my bay or something. Their kids in the car, not the keys in the car. I mean, they're there 2 seconds before the police can get there.
What are you talking about, business?
Oh, I have a car wash done so for me. So I have, they've rescued more people and time and stuff. And I'm looking through all the new proposed uses. One of them, you're doing the toy companies, you're basically taking them out of.
You're saying
almost everything.
I hear that we're towing the company.
They're a towing company and repair shops. So that's something that I kind of thought that was a little harsh. I mean, I think the EP1, EP2 is a great zoning for that type of use. And I think it's a great service. We're right next to Socomi Pass. I mean, these guys now that I've moved out and go to Issaquah, where are you going to find something in Issaquah? And the other one is I'm reviewing some stuff, you know, getting ready to work on some of my property. And the other thing I have is I have the EP1 zoning currently in my property, and I have a document to adopt a use to my property as a car wash. I'd like to expand and bring this use up to my family for growth and everything. I think it's a really needed service environmentally for the biggest break in the valley, but it's one thing I've noticed that getting ready to kind of work on that is the setbacks, the landscaping setbacks. It's very restrictive, and that, especially that type of zoning, EP1, which is more of a heavier commercial use, and that's with the cost of everything, all the regulations we have to go through, the mitigation fees we have paid for, and we pay so much high price per square foot of the property, you know, so now we're giving up, you know, 15 feet over on the whole property. It eats up huge amount of property. And I guarantee you anybody that's neighbors of EP1 could care less if you have 2 feet of landscaping or 5 feet or you're right to the property line. I think it's an added cost and expense onto the property owners and small business who want to grow and develop into the community. So that's something I would like to push to this. I think that's very restrictive and cost prohibitive for our small business. I think it eats up so much property. Property is so expensive. So anyway, those are my little thoughts.
Okay. Well, Mr. Eddie, thank you very much for coming here and making those comments. Jamie, just real quick, the permitted uses table, is that going to council? Is that where it's at?
Yes. A council committee wanted to review it again. So they meet next on March 13th at 4 o'clock. It's usually the 20th, but we've updated the schedule. They need to plan. Council will need one more hearing before they can pass that. They just had their retreat this week, and there's a lot of There's a lot of things floating around and about the zoning overall throughout the city, changes, you know, being proposed that that he just talked about, and actually adding in a couple of new zones. So I think you guys would be seeing that for comp plan updates and zoning updates. So what I don't know is if I'll know more March 13th if they want to go ahead and move forward, or I think we might need a little bit more time to get some of these other things addressed. But generally, they what I've been seeing is they've been wanting to allow more uses. They've kind of backed off somewhat since, you know, you guys provided your recommendation, and then they seemed to kind of go away from that and had some of their ideas. They seem to be coming back to a lot of things. So they're still moving things around a little bit, and it's still open.
Thank you for that update. Mr. Eddy, did you catch that somewhere around middle to end of March that the council will be mm-hmm. taking up and having a public hearing where you'll be able to make those comments to the council as well?
Yes, that's March the 13th. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've been talking about it.
Yeah.
All right. Next item on our agenda is item number 4, introduction of the tree retention amendments to North Bend Municipal Code, Chapter 19.10, clearing, grading, and drainage. Okay. Ms. Burrell.
Yeah. So we'll kind of both tag team on introducing and going over some information, and then we can, you know, take questions and kind of go through things with you. This is introduction. You know, we've talked about this code and amending it for a while. I can give you a kind of a picture from my world of trying to implement, you know, what we have and things we've been hearing. For example, a single family plat development requires 30% of the significant trees to be retained, and then the code allows for all the zones for you to go down 10%. And what we had been hearing mostly from council was, we don't want you to allow that 10% reduction. You know, we really want to keep this look, the trees, as much as we can. It's important to us, and we're seeing all this development, and we're seeing the trees you know, go away, is how people feel. And you would also get, you know, some lots that might have only one or two significant trees, and then those two are gone. So it's always a balance trying to retain, to build around, to protect. Our regulations now are pretty weak in that area as far as the protection, and we had some projects that the trees ended up getting damaged during construction and they died. So we're trying to prevent that from happening. We're trying to, where we can, intersperse trees in developments like Quadrant. I had them maintain the 30%, the new plat down at off Stilson. Didn't give them the reduction. And then for whatever significant trees they removed, they would still had to replant. And they try to do that as much on-site as they can, but sometimes you run out of space, so we have the fee and lieu program where you can pay for trees off-site. Instead of allowing off-site, council had given direction, we really want you to try to get as many trees back on the site as you can, just to minimize that change in the landscape. And so I worked with them, and they're putting a few trees back on lots, you know, and these are the 4 units per acre lots, you know, 7,000 to 10,000 square feet. And so we're going to see how that works with putting trees back in. So that's just kind of some background of, you know, why we were hearing, hey, let's look at this. So I've consulted with Jim, and this is his specialty, and he works with a lot of different cities. And he said, you know, why don't we look at this tree unit credit, which he can explain a little bit better. But, you know, basically now we go out and we only count the large significant trees, and then you only have to retain 30%. So you go out to a site. We went out to Maloney Grove 13 recently, if you know where that one is, the one being cleared right now off Maloney Grove. And you stand there and you look around, and this was before they started moving things, and you're like, well, what about that one and that one and this one? And so what we were seeing is they weren't saving some of the non-significant trees that were right next to the significant trees. So some common sense wasn't, you know, happening because it wasn't shown on the plans. They weren't planning for that. And so what we were saying with this code is that we want you to pick which ones you want to save, and they can be small and they can be big, and you get a little more credit for one that's bigger up to a certain point. But, you know, you pick which ones you're going to focus on saving and what makes sense, and let's save those. Inventorying the whole property isn't very effective for anyone. It costs them more money, and it's not really something we use. We don't need to know every single tree if then you're just going to cut 70% of them. So that's one piece of it. And, you know, a lot that doesn't have trees on it right now, you wouldn't be required to add any beyond landscaping if you had required landscaping. So this would have some planting going back to a lot that otherwise wouldn't have any. What we've been doing with plat conditions, kind of getting to number four on the memo, is that because our regulations haven't been very strong in a lot of areas, we've been putting plat conditions on to say, to get to that critical root zone figure that you see in the regulations, to say you have to protect and you have to make sure during grading, you know, these trees are protected. And the other thing we've done is we've been giving credit for the smaller trees 2-to-1, because as Jim will talk to a lot, is that the smaller trees can grow up in the environment better. They can be protected easier. You know, a bigger tree is just going to be a lot more impacted by a new development next to it. So there's value in the smaller trees. So we've been actually doing some of this informally through plat conditions and giving credit. And these are just some points to that. The critical root zone, definitions. Enforcement is an area that we've expanded on. You know, if you do damage or if you do take a tree that you weren't supposed to take. We added in some provisions on an exceptional tree. We wanted to get your thoughts on that and what those are. And then, like I said, the tree retention plan, just to define better what requirements we're expecting an applicant to provide and how to comply with city code. It's pretty vague right now. And so the table just hopes to help. There's a lot of code here, and we don't expect you to have read all of it or understood all of it at this point. So hopefully the table is helpful, and you guys have had a chance to look at it. I'm sure there's a lot of other things I'm forgetting. But did you want to add anything at the beginning, or go over any of your slides?
I think one of the big things that you talked about that's really different in this proposed code is recognizing smaller trees instead of just the larger trees. And can you pull up that? I have an older PowerPoint that I've used in other places, but it's got a lot of extra slides in it. Can you, go to 11 there? The point here is that right now your code requires retention of just trees 15 inches and over. So you're leaving out a lot of smaller trees. And that's good, you're recognizing large trees, but the problem with just recognizing large trees is sometimes that's all you're saving. Larger trees, a lot of times, are harder to save because they require a much larger critical root zone to protect. So you're really protecting more of that area. They're more exposed to the wind. You're losing a lot of screening compared to shrubs or smaller trees. Whereas if you were to give some credit for retaining smaller trees, you actually don't have to protect as much of the critical root zone because they're smaller trees. They acclimate to the site easier as they grow up over time. They give you early screening early on also, and they just function better early on instead of trying to retain just large trees that are really, a lot of times, more susceptible to blowing over. So I'm actually surprised that Rob was so adamantly against this, because I thought that this, and several other cities have gone to this, because they recognize so many other sized trees instead of just the big ones, that gives them credit and allows them to save smaller trees or plant trees and get credit for planting smaller trees. Because the goal eventually is that you have more canopy, and the nice thing about trees is that they grow larger over time. So whether you save large trees or small trees, eventually you're going to have a lot more canopy. So the point is that we try to save as many trees that will be viable for as long as possible.
Do you have any other slides you want to?
Let's see. Okay. We're probably not right yet. But did everybody understand the tree unit credit idea? That it was so many credits per 1,000 square feet that were required, and to meet that you get certain number of credits depending on the size of the tree. The larger the tree, the more credits you get.
Where the credits went to the developer.
Credits are linked to the tree that is retained on the site. In other words,
who gets the credit for that tree?
Well,
the property gets the credit.
The site itself is required to retain a minimum number of tree credits.
So we're switching from percentages to credits.
Correct.
Right, with this.
Correct.
One of the other advantages that Jamie also mentions is that if you have a completely cleared site with no trees on it, your present code doesn't require any tree planting. There's no trees, there's not going to be any trees. This code will at least require the developer to plant some trees to bring it up to a certain number of tree credits.
Okay, so there's going to be a minimum. Right.
And that chart is on page 15 of your handout. It shows
the credits, and then the required minimum is the page before, 14.
And the other big part of this is that we really tried to define what the expectations were for the tree protection plans, because I've been doing this for about 30 plus years, and but it really helps to have good information up front and know what exactly you're going to retain and how it's going to retain, and to work with the developer to protect trees, because too often I get calls way after the fact and trees are already damaged or buried or broken, and there's nothing a lot of times I can do about it. We just have to accept what's happened, and a lot of times those trees end up declining and failing over time. Whereas if we get good information up front, we clearly identify the trees that are going to be retained. We show it on the plan. We protect them during construction. We talk about them if there's going to be any impact near those trees with the developer. It's a lot more beneficial and practical to do that before the damage occurs. And that's what the tree protection requirements for the plan are in here in this plan.
Okay. Thank you very much for that introduction. So I'll turn to the Planning Commission. My idea before going through this is to look at the table that Jamie provided us, which is the existing tree code and proposed tree code. And after we kind of talk about anything, any thoughts you have there is to go through the document and talk about any questions or changes you have page by page if we need to. Does that sound okay? Mm-hmm. All right. I'm sorry?
Big picture, then small picture.
Right.
Okay. So on the third page of the memo is the existing tree code and proposed tree code. And under definitions, the significant tree. And I guess if I can just start with that top box. In the document, the significant tree is at 4 inches. And then the definition of tree was a 4-inch tree. And so if we go all the way down to 4 inches, that means so many more significant trees. And I kind of looked at the trees in my yard, and I said, well, a 4-inch tree, and not to ignore the what survivability or is going to survive better, I think that's a valid argument that I'm not, you know, a knowledgeable person to make. But I was thinking that it might be a little bit too restrictive when I see how much gets reseeded and replanted around my trees and goes through, and I keep thinning out. Now, granted, those are 2 inches and 3 inches, but they seem to just come up so quickly. And maybe I should ask this question, is at 4 inches, a cedar tree is 5 years old, or how old would you think?
Yeah, 5 to 6 years. Probably, it's difficult to say because trees grow depending on the soils that they're in and the conditions that they're growing under. So, you know, it's average probably.
Somewhere around that.
5, 6 years old.
And they grow 12 or so inches a year? Vertically?
Yes.
Vertically, I should say. How much in diameter would they grow?
They could put on a half an inch a year, probably, average, or more if they were really good condition and vigorous.
So I'm putting this to the commission. My thought is that if we're recognizing a tree at 4, maybe that's not the correct one, but to have a recognition of a tree at 4 and significant tree that's subject to all this code, I don't see we have a good match yet. So I'm asking you to think about that and think about what the significant tree size is and how it should be handled in the code. And if you guys have any thoughts, I'd love to hear it.
Right. Or Jim, if you have thoughts of why you came up with the 4 or recommended that.
I think the word significant might be, maybe there's an understanding that that's a special tree, whereas my interpretation of it is that it's a viable tree, a tree that will actually thrive and grow.
So maybe that's
the difference that we're talking about. You're maybe talking, it's not exceptional, significant is more than viable.
Right.
I don't know. So that's probably just a word.
I think in our code, because I read through it and I kept seeing a significant tree is subject to this and this and this. And so I'm wondering, is that the 4-inch tree that's going to have all these regulations and requirements to it that exist in our code? Or do we need to think in scale terms or something else that matches what we're trying to achieve? And I don't know the answer. I'm just asking the question. You know, if a significant tree is defined as 4 inches, and yet significant trees are subject to all the conditions in this code of 30 pages, is that the right measurement? So that's all I'm trying to figure out.
I think the language is something that, because when we talk about, I did the same thing. I went out and looked and went 4 inches. You know, I think we're going to have a lot of responses. I'll have to get a permit to take down that little tree in my front yard.
No, that's not it.
And but again, when we're looking at language, they see significant tree and we're calling a 4-inch tree significant tree. I think is that a language that's used consistently in other ordinances, or is there a way for us to further parse between them? Because then you add exceptional tree into the mix, which to me an exceptional tree would be like a miracle of old growth that managed to survive on the valley floor. Or a tree that is somehow connected to a historical event. So language matters, and the word choice that we use matters, and how that's conveyed to people. So when you tell them this 4-inch tree is a significant tree, I think it gets an immediate, really. It creates a kind of a disconnect for people. So can we pick a different word? Or is it that we're dealing with something that is how those are referred to within the industry?
You know, maybe viable is a better word. And I think the reason that we have any word or we have either significant or viable is that what we're trying to do is the reason that we're giving a tree a certain significance is that it is then given credit and the developer gets to use that tree for credit.
Mm-hmm. It's not meant to restrict anybody.
It's actually meant to provide an incentive for that developer. Because right now, I mean, a good example is the Tanner site that we've been working on recently. It's a big site, and they found like 250 trees, significant trees on that site. When I went to the site, there are thousands of trees that are just under that 15-inch size. So there are thousands of trees that right now that the developer gets no credit for. And aren't even recognized as significant, viable, whatever trees. And so this code would give a lot more credit to the developer for saving all those smaller trees.
What is the credit they get, Jim? I'm still not clear. What is the credit? Is it financial? What is it?
It's just a value that's placed on a tree based on its size.
But what value is that to the developer? I don't understand.
It's a requirement to meet the tree canopy under the code, right?
Yeah.
It's on page 14.
Is that a correct way to say it? So you need so many credits to make sure you meet code.
The table on page 14 has, depending on your land use type, what credits you need. If you can show you meet those credits, you don't have to, you can remove everything else. And the credits are based on the size of the trees that you see. So it's a calculation, but it's just saying you have to meet that minimum tree credit. And if you meet that through a bunch of 4-inch, 6-inch, 8-inch, you can take everything else.
So let's put that in a real life example. Maybe that'll help. If we have one of our CLDR properties, 18,000 square feet, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in a single family home, you need one credit per 1,000 square feet. So with 18,000, you need 18. And so in order to get those 18 tree credits,
right,
I could have three 24-inch or above trees, and I would meet it. I could have a mix of a whole bunch of different other ones to meet it. So it depends on what's on that site or what they want to keep or if they want to do a mix. It's kind of, in a way, I see this as flexible, right? Because you can site it the way you want and keep trees in one area. You know, is that...
Mm-hmm.
Does this maybe show a little bit about, let's say this is a plat here, and I don't know how many square feet this is, but let's say it's an acre and you need, what do we need, 44 credits?
Mm-hmm.
44 credits. So then the developer could come in on this site and he could find viable trees here that were large enough to meet the credits that is required for this 1 acre site. If he can find them all here, he could survey them, protect them, and then he wouldn't have to go out and even mess with the rest of these trees on the site.
That's the problem we have now with this cottage house. That's exactly the problem. There's nothing in the middle. The trees are all in the corners, and there's no canopy. It's like corn.
And that's the dilemma that I see. The credit concept's great. On the surface, it's like, hey, wow, we get credit for little trees and big trees, and now it's up to the developer to figure out which ones he wants to keep based on his plan.
Right.
But when I take it to the next level and start looking at the engineering process and designing and building roads and where's the water line coming in, where's the sewer line going in, at that stage, I'm not going to take the risk of trying to save trees in my plan, because I can tell you what it's going to cost for the engineering work, the infrastructure. That's a bid. I know the number. I've got to work around the tree in the beginning. That's a fuzzy math thing. And if I've got to worry about protecting the tree all the way through the development process until I get building permits, that's another risk factor. So I guess the struggle I have is just basically saying protecting the trees is great. Calling them significant is fuzzy math. And the credit needs to be very significant to get a developer to say, I should pay attention. And I don't know if we've gotten to the point of significant for the value, the dollar value, in the process at the time when they need to make those decisions. Does that make sense?
I'm not following. I'm not sure.
If you take a bare piece of land, the developer says, this is how many lots I can get out of it. The very next thing he's going to say is, what's my topography? What are my costs for engineering? What is it going to cost me to actually get those lots to be buildable?
Right.
Trees are way out on the horizon of analysis because there's not enough value.
Right, but I'm assuming that the city is requiring the developer to either protect or plant trees. So that's a part of the equation that's not distant.
Yeah.
My
right.
So that's where I'm not understanding.
So and what I'm saying is, it's already today's code and anybody's tree code is fuzzy. It's not clear at the stage where the developer's making decisions about the value of the land based on the cost of production at the end, 3 years out, when he can actually sell a house.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if there's not some other way to dial in on the dollar value rather than just say, we're going to give you credits toward your permit, because you have to have so many credits. There's no thought about the dollar cost when that tree, I could say one, I'm just picking a number, I could say 3 15-inch trees and put them in a park, and I don't have to have a single other tree in the plat. That's an easy math thing to do that I can do really early on. I can pick out my 3 trees, and I can know that I can clean them all the rest of them out because I've got my credits over here. So I'm just, the developer's mindset is not syncing up with what I'm reading. They're going to want a quick answer, not a call the engineer and study some more numbers, get some real math done. You've got to design roads before you can decide whether you can protect a tree, right? Because you've got topography and wetlands to work around before you can start talking about saving trees. So I'm just...
Well, it says in the code, though, public right-of-way areas to be dedicated as public right-of-way and vehicular access easements not included as lot area within the improved plat and shall be excluded from the area used for calculation of tree density.
But you still have to design those routes. You have to lay out where are the roads, where are the curb sites, where are the... You have to lay all that out.
But you could do it in a... Let's say you had a an option to, you're going to make a T, but you can make a short, a medium, or a long T, right? Or, you know, offset. And if you could save the trees you needed to by just moving that street a little bit, you know, it might work.
More likely you're going to, if you need to get credits, if the requirement to get X number of lots includes getting so many tree credits, you're going to do that as quickly as you can in order to move on to the next page of the analysis, which is a lot more money, the engineering piece.
Yes.
To spin off what you're saying, it almost sounds like you're suggesting we're incentivizing the very behavior that has resulted in people freaking out.
They're not going to take the time.
Because all of the trees are gone in the middle, and they're just trees on the edges.
If I've got to spend as much energy to save a 4-credit tree as I need to spend energy to save a 30-credit tree, I'm going to pay attention to the 30-credit tree. Exactly what they're doing right now with no change in the code.
Yeah, I think it depends on the site because they're all laid out differently. So, like I said, some flats you go to and there's 40 smaller trees and then one big one and then 40 smaller ones and one big one. I mean, there's always a different mix. And I think they're going to capitalize on whatever they can to get the tree credits, too.
Question. I've read this, I don't know how many times, but I'm asking you because you've been working with it very closely. Do we have something in here that gives you the ability to say, no, we're not going to let you do that stand of trees in the corner, we need to see if we're spread across the property? Do we have that? Or essentially, are we changing things around a little bit?
I think what may have changed was that the developer used to be able to buy his way out by buying trees so they could move into the plan. That's not being allowed now. It's being used in a very, very marginal way for the Dave has the provision either. Agree to sell a tree or not, but the idea is not to sell a tree, but to work around the tree. Where now it's basically automatic. It seems to me in the past that the office has just allowed the trees to be bought, taken out as a quid pro quo. And it makes sense. If you got the small lots, big buildings, working around trees, making them up, they're going to become marginal trees, and so the idea is to avoid that, but the trade-off is you're going to end up with a project that has very little trees inside the core community aesthetics committee. And in a way, I agree with that. I agree with the change in the inability to simply assume that you can buy your way out of a tree by things more direct to have to work around that tree in a way that preserves it.
So
it doesn't side with the cost of developing the property. It does side with the community need to see more trees central to the properties rather than decentralizing the trees. And it would encourage planting established, at least trees that are maybe 4'2" out of the ground, bring in trees that will establish themselves rather quickly. Not just conifers, but also broadleaf trees to provide that mix. But so I think the change in the planting setting community is the flip. We've gone from automatically selling trees in the way from that, then requiring them to retain a work around it. Mm-hmm. I think that's the biggest change in this whole provision.
Mm-hmm. Dick, I love your idea. But then when I drive through Tanglewood or Cedar Falls or the cottages at North Bend and I think about putting my cedars in between those houses, it's not working. And so I'm trying to figure out how we can blend the code into what we have it inside city limits and put those big trees in the canopies that we want to have. And I don't know, I kind of... Go ahead.
This is Growth Management Act. This is jam houses close together, don't use a lot of land, and this is pushback saying, well, you folks... building in density, now you want the trees back again. You can't have both. So we've ended up with trees in little pockets here and there, and after 10 years the neighborhood's developed and there's a few trees. Now it doesn't look like just a bare streetscape, but that tree that was left is now storm damaged. Somebody says it's going to fall on the roof, so they go cut it after the fact. And so, I mean, I want to struggle and get a best balance, but let's not forget this got screwed up when we all allowed the rules to change to say we're going to jam density into small space and now treat each plat in its own process. I would rather say to a developer, if you want to stick with a credit analysis, give them tons of credit for saving, I'll use the old term, significant tree, which is a big tree that nobody's going to dispute. Hey, that's a significant tree.
We call them extraordinary trees.
And also, to add to that, it's a significant tree that's likely to live another 100 years, or another 75 years at least, so that you know it's not going to just die because of its own age. If we give the developer credit to make sure those trees stay in place, then the rest of it will work. He'll work it out. They'll work out the engineering, the planning, because at the end of the day, the neighborhood looks best if there's some established vegetation. So we're trying to come in and fix a problem that, I always come back to this, the developer's going to fix it if we give them the tools to fix it. If we layer rules and stuff, we've got 4-inch trees they got to worry about all of a sudden. Now the house is up 20% and it's not going to sell. The developer's going to back away from the whole project because we've created this anomaly that's expensive for them to deal with.
So, hold on. What I understood from your discussion is give more credit for larger trees.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We talked about that.
Not mix in smaller trees that all of a sudden, well, I mean, it will take...
I say keep it and keep the flexibility, right?
You do get more credits for the larger trees.
But because we're layering in down to the 4-inch, which I consider a small tree,
right?
It goes from significant to layman's terms to insignificant.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It would be expensive just to address it.
You don't have to address it if you meet them all with the larger trees.
Okay, then I guess the default's going to be what I said earlier. They're all going to do the same thing.
But again, I feel like it's going to depend on the site and where your road's lining out and where your houses are and where the trees are. So
does this
can go either way?
So maybe this works best if there are no 15-inch trees on the property. then this credit scenario starts to make sense because there are no big ones.
Right.
And they're going to do the math to save as many.
Yeah.
As, you know.
Well, it's just really flexible. It works best on all sites because it'll give credit for large and small trees. And we find every one of these sites is different. I mean, it's like the Maloney site is like an old homestead, and it had some interesting old non-named trees on it, too, that we wanted to try to retain and should be retained. Good example. So this is just allowing flexibility depending on what the site provides.
One fact point might help me kind of dial my thought in. If I said, Jim, I'm looking at a 4-inch tree, whatever species, and I'm deciding whether I'm going to keep it so I can have the credit, or I'm going to cut it down and plant a new 4-inch tree, what would it cost me? Because I can buy a 4-inch tree.
Right, right. It would cost you probably, I don't know, $1,000 maybe to do it right and get a good tree.
That's what I was saying. A 4-inch tree.
That's a big tree.
That's a 80-foot tree. That's big. Then you have to get that all set. It's not easy to plant.
I think there's some magic numbers there.
And remember, you know, if the developer saves smaller trees, he has to save quite a few more smaller trees, whereas if he saves larger trees, he saves fewer. So there's a trade-off either way.
So do you think, given that concept of the smaller tree being worth an expensive $1,000 to replace it, how does that balance against the 15-inch tree credit-wise?
Well, if you're taking all small trees, you might have to replace 5 or 6 or 8 small trees versus one large 15-inch tree, depending on how the credit's going.
Okay, so using the smaller lots that we have and we're talking about here, that 15-inch tree, in order to protect it, I'm guessing the developer's going to have to write off the same amount of space as you would for a building lot. Does that sound about right?
No.
The buffer around it, the root system and all?
No. No, 15-inch tree has, and here's where we get a little technical about critical root zones and what is allowed within that critical root zone. Technically, here we can look at the description. Yeah, it's on page 6, but also we've got a...
Oh, you
want to
look at your...
Yeah.
Which one?
And when we talk about critical root zones, we're talking about the root system of a tree, all right, which is not symmetrical. Its roots are opportunistic. They're going to grow where they can. And there's a lot of variables. There's tree species, there's soil depth, there's soil moisture, there's slope. There's a lot of things involved. But to have a start, we say that a critical root zone is based on the size of the trunk of the tree. And generally we say that for every inch diameter, the critical root zone is 1 foot radius. Okay, so for that 15-inch diameter tree, we have a 15-foot critical root zone. If we stayed 15 feet away from that tree, generally that tree would be safe.
And that's similar to...
So that's a 30-foot diameter.
Okay.
That's
however,
what we do now, too.
What's the width of a typical building lot in the system we're talking about?
What, 68 is a building lot?
Minimum, yeah. 70, I think, is our minimum now.
But here again...
20 feet in between...
But you can. I mean, we still, that's the ideal tree protection area. We talk about that we can actually go inside this critical root zone. We call this the inner critical root zone. We can actually go inside this area, too. If this was on the back of a lot, you could actually build up to this point right here, halfway in, 7.5 feet.
Or dig a foundation or whatever.
Dig a foundation or whatever.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't you wouldn't want to do that, Jim, because that tree.
We try not, but that's the absolute max.
So close to the structure in 5 years.
Yeah, that would be.
And you wouldn't do that in the planning process.
No, but I'm okay.
It's not ideal. Yeah, you're not going
to
see it.
Let's say a parking lot. If a parking lot wanted to come up that close, then you could probably do that.
On one side.
That close.
Yeah. So back to my point. I'm trying to see if I'm totally off base or I'm close. maybe it's three trees, three 15-inch trees that would actually absorb what I call a building line.
Mm-hmm. Well, they may or may
not. So do that math, if I play that math out, today's world, that's probably a $150,000 decision the developer's going to make. Because he's given up a building lot to protect three trees.
If the trees are situated in the right place on the building lot, he can still build on the lot. And that's the decision he can make, depending on where the trees are located. Right.
So. And I think with, you know, cottage and 4 units per acre, it would be hard to save a lot of the larger trees with amongst the lots. You're going to get some, and we do see some around the perimeter.
Just,
but
just dawns on me that we could be finding an opportunity here to use variable-sized homes in amongst very variable-sized trees instead of having structures being automatically the same footprint, vary the size of the footprint to adapt to the trees that you're building in. And that would create a very interesting community.
And I even take the same point, Dick, and say the credit scenario may be a great resource, but maybe we're not giving enough credit to the concept of, and I, to me, I look at it very clearly. See, a building lot is worth X, and I'm going to spend X amount of money to get a building lot. And if I've got to spend money to cut a tree down and plant three others, that's simple math. It's a business decision. And over time, if it takes me 2 years to get all the entitlement stuff done, at day one, I'm not going to start working with the trees unless there's a real big incentive for me to do that. I'm going to assume that I don't have them or I do have them and go forward. So if we're talking about protecting trees, maybe the credit conversation, it should be something around making sure the credit is a match for the value that we perceive in keeping the tree. I'm not sure we're there on that.
So you think it should be great?
Get more.
Yeah, I think the smaller trees, that's great. It's a unique, creative way to look at it. But part of me is thinking, if you really want to put the money where our mouth is you need to make sure the credit to keep the tree is significant enough.
So you say increase the incentive to retain larger trees.
Correct.
So right now, a 12 to 24-inch tree provides 4 credits. Versus a 4 to 8-inch tree is half a credit.
Yeah, that's so, like Dick was saying, I'm not sure I can connect credits to dollars very easily. But something,
well, I can't either. I don't know how we do that with dollars.
Sure. It could be done on a specific site based on the number of lots that's coming out of the site. You could do it that way. I mean, the old school technique, it really was a technique. You get the planning process done, you do your engineering work, you build the roads, and you would have made an application to protect and include 3 or 4 significant trees around the plat, and you wouldn't touch the lots next to those trees until the last couple of houses were built. And somehow or another, because of the D8 that drove by that tree 15 times in a week, tree died.
Yep.
Then you plan to take it down because it's a hazard. Well, gee, I got my building lot back. That's the game. They all play it.
Well, that's why the protection plan is implemented and followed through to the end. That's the purpose of that.
Yeah, we can look at...
And there's even a possible bond on the trees that are supposed to be retained.
Good idea.
So
I think that's a lousy idea.
Bond?
Yeah. I think it's a lousy idea.
Say why.
I'm buying a property. I'm buying the house. I'm insured that. I should be able to...
So the bond is meant to be during construction. Yeah. If it's damaged, then the bond goes away.
It sticks with the tree. As I'm reading this, it goes into beyond the construction, into the acquisition. The homeowner now is required to keep that tree healthy. What I read, that really causes me a problem.
That's not how I...
That would be just
the bond is
just
for
construction.
The last construction and acceptance of the...
No, it runs with the land. In other words, it goes into the deed that these trees now are marked and are to be preserved.
Well, I guess you can do that if you want.
It talks about it in this ordinance, which causes the problem.
We'll have to look at that. I don't know.
just trying to see if I see that in the table before we go into
it. Is that towards the end? Maybe?
Yes.
Yeah,
page
27.
Through construction. So B, 1910-140B, that was our intention. It's just a construction bond for the applicant, and then it goes away.
Yeah, it says through construction.
Okay, well, you're going to maybe go through that again, but it hit me hard. I was getting ready to end it. That's all this, this part where it goes into the ownership now, the transfer ownership.
No. No, that would be too onerous.
And they can't even, if the tree, unless the tree is dying.
There are sections in there that do address what Dick's talking about.
Yeah. And I think that's a big leap. I've got 13 extraordinary trees on my little acre. 13 old growth trees that I'm grandfathered in. I won't be subject to this code, but somebody else who may buy it will be. And I'm just that
only could be helped.
That doesn't go with the value of the land. I mean, it's a felony. I don't think we can do that.
You bring up a question I need to understand. So, an average homeowner who's lived in a property, whether they just bought it yesterday or they've been there for 30 years, they're not going to be impacted by this particular code in any way, right?
Maybe they're referring to the top of page 27. There's talk about if the homeowners association and their maintenance for ongoing tree care in the open spaces and the native growth protection easements. We have that already in place. Then they would have that obligation for the common space, for the neighborhood. But I never interpreted it to mean on the individual lots. In that case, the way we've dealt with it is, yeah, once it turns over and the cottages at North Bend homes get occupied, if we've left a large tree and that homeowner doesn't feel comfortable with it, they come in, they remove it. You know, we don't want to get into too much liability.
We don't really have throughout the city a tree ordinance related to an individual's tree, like they do in other parts of the state.
No.
I think I'm going to go back. Rob picked up, I'm sure. I'm going to go back and make sure, because what I think we have here is something to keep the community from doing what happened in Seattle, where somebody just came and cleared his hillside to get a better view. Code is trying to prevent that from happening in this town. What I'm saying is a pretty heavy-handed, almost ham-handed way. I don't think it's legal to say a homeowner can't do with his property what he or she thinks is right to do.
Yeah.
If I want to plant a lawn in the area where that tree is, that tree's for it's not allowing me to plant a lawn, I'm going to take it down.
Right.
And I should have the right to do that. It may not be good sense, but I should have the right to do that. Right. But in this, it says that I would be violating this, some part of this code. I wouldn't be given a permit to be able to do that. I understand getting permits for safety reasons, for liability reasons, but not to stop the person from doing something.
What we had proposed was to actually reduce the burden for individual homeowners. Now they need to get a permit. It's free, and they need to replant. Even if they have 20 other trees on their lot, they still need to replant. What we added was an exemption from this if they are not proposing development, and we did say they should meet the minimum tree credit, so they should still have some trees on their lot. But if they have 20 other trees, they can go take 10 of them. Well, they don't even need a permit, because it's burdensome for us to have to issue permits. And we never, like I said, we never contest it. If they want to take a tree down, it's their lot.
So
we've actually tried to loosen that for single-family homeowners.
I appreciate that, Jamie. I'm just looking at the document that we have on page 23. It's redlined out, but is that the title of the section, Tree Retention Requirements for Proposed Project Development?
Right, so that's our existing. That's what we have existing.
So whatever the header is for this entire section, something about new development or redevelopment of a property, property that helps guide the reader to what's below only applies to those instances, so it's not something that applies to current homeowners, right? And I think that's what Dick is kind of debating. It's not clear that it doesn't apply to homeowners.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we can make sure that we have a header for the section, or however you're going to design it or organize it. That would be helpful.
So that whole section on 23 goes away. Where we've added in the sections, we have said, we've called them new development sites. We've tried to make that clear, that really a lot of this is for new development sites.
But this just, right. All I'm left with is 19.10.110 maintenance responsibilities.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at paragraph, at page 27, paragraph B, where it starts out, trees designated protection for construction, including mitigation planting, shall be apt and bonded to be protected and retained. Any of these trees that are removed after this destination, other than being hazardous, shall be bonded. Bond shall be based on the appraised landscape value applied to city arborists using this additional guide, blah, blah, blah. $2,500 per tree. Enforcement for retained trees and supplemental trees on new development sites. And it goes on, it just talks about the trees being required to be retained after the purchase of the property.
Not after the purchase of the property, after the designation of the tree as being one that they're going to keep according to the requirement.
Through construction.
Does that make sense? So once
the builders, but when the buyer takes title,
that tree
is still protected.
No. Through construction. So when we issued final plat and all the lots are created, construction's over. It's already. Off.
Maybe the words through construction should be at the end of that sentence. Would that be more clear?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
It goes right on through. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's probably where. The...
We can make sure that's clear.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay.
We can even retitle the security and enforcement through construction. I mean, something to be real clear, you know.
Yes, through construction.
Yes, since we're on this section of reading, I see the loophole that Mr. Lincoln was talking about still exists. And such trees are damaged and or removed, the applicant shall be responsible for them, blah, blah, blah. Before that. So C, number one, trees that are shown on a plan as to be retained as part of the minimum tree density requirement should not be damaged and or removed during or as a...
So that is clear now, it's true construction.
Well, so yeah, so I guess what this is going to look like is somebody's going to go out, they're going to look at the land, they're going to see that, okay, you know, they're at whatever stage of construction, grading, leveling, there's no damage. So.
We can release the bond. Right.
We release the bond.
This fund after. I was talking about before construction, right? We go out, we make sure, okay, this is healthy, this is the critical.
Mm-hmm. Well, they designate the trees that they want to save.
Exactly.
Right. Then we verify that before they take bulldozers and grade. And
so
then
if that's damaged during construction.
Right. Right. If it's not, then we respond and we move on.
Yeah. Okay. So they can just replant that tree according to the guidelines, and if they don't, then the city has the money to. Okay, so let's go back. Anything on this table, or do you want to go right into the code?
Should that be, just back to that one point, should that be a varying scale based on the size of the tree? Because I can see in some situations that they, $1,000, that's worth it. Whereas, you know, depending on the significance of that tree or the viability of it, you know, whichever term, you know, it should be. Per inch,
I think the value is described based on the landscape appraised value in here somewhere. What is that, Jim?
I saw that, but
right.
In this section.
But then it says not less than 2,500
on
27.
Okay. But then down below, it says responsible for paying a fine of $1,000 per tree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I had a similar question, and Jim's response, you know, was just, it puts them on notice. I mean, it does catch their attention.
It's an incentive.
Right.
To protect what they've put in the ground. Because I can tell you, a lot of times they just throw things in and figure everybody's going to not be watching, and then, you know, development's over with and the trees are dead or dying, and you know, there's no nothing to come back on to hold them to it.
Well, I guess my question is that enough of a
okay.
Curtis, so question. In the development or design standards where you have to retain 30% of mm-hmm. your trees and you had an allowance of 10%, does the 10% allowance still exist today? Or
With the proposed code?
No.
Today, yes. It does, but we haven't been giving it out as freely. Oh. Yeah. It was administrative, yeah.
So where we, as a commission, were struggling before was with that allowance.
Right.
And so just keep that in mind. I wasn't sure where you're going to propose or what you're thinking, but to me, there's going to be a 30% coverage, then I might be more flexible if we change that part of it.
Yeah, no, I guess I'm not going there.
Okay.
It's just more of increasing the incentive to retain the trees that are there. You know, in having enough of a deterrent to actually be effective. You know, I don't know if it's $1,000 or not in construction. I don't sell trees. Sometimes it seems like fees are insignificant compared to the convenience of violating those things. And so, if our goal is to retain trees,
in my notes, I put $5,000 down for a 15 or larger.
Well, I think we're getting some things confused here because the bond originally is based on the appraised landscape value of
2,500.
And let's show you an example.
Appraised landscape value of the tree?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Where's the where'd it go?
No.
We lost the rest of it.
They go.
Is it to be slided over or something?
There we go. Yes. Where's that?
I was going to show you that one of the things that we did for Seattle Housing and King County Housing. No, we're looking for a sign.
The sign.
Yeah. There you missed it. Okay. Seattle Housing and King County Housing was so adamant about protecting the trees that they wanted to protect is that they asked us to do a landscape appraisal on every tree. And we would put these signs up on the tree protection fences, and that caught the contractor's attention. We were getting calls finally from contractors who needed to go closer to that tree than that fence allowed. In fact, in one case, the city was so adamant about protecting trees, they added $20,000 to every appraised tree that we did. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing that gets their attention.
So Mr. Corbin did that with the project downtown. They put the on the fences around each of the trees and along the.
That's probably down. Filled with that.
That wasn't a part of that.
So
that gets your attention.
Well, I was going to say it gets the right person's attention.
Right.
Right.
It's the guy who they hired for the day.
You're right. The general, he agrees to all this stuff, but it's all the subs who come in a month later who never were part of the earlier meeting, and he goes, well, $37,000, man, I don't want to touch that thing. And then I'll get a call and say, we just need to do this. You know, we're still 15 feet from the tree. Well, okay, we can probably still do that. But that keeps people from just going in there really not.
It also really drives home this whole credit concept. You say dollars, everybody understands dollars. Nobody understands credits.
Right, yeah.
So my question is, though, but this isn't for a 4-inch tree. At what point does this, work or is warranted?
For a 4-inch tree?
No, it's not.
I don't think it works for a 4-inch tree. At it would still
be worth like $1,000 or $2,000 or something like that. It depends on. You know.
You could clump them together. You know, if you a lot of times you'll have the fencing around a group of trees, and you could put the appraised value for that group.
Yeah, we do appraised values for trees all the time, and that can be done.
I think I'm in line with what Curtis is thinking, is that just seems insignificant when you're selling a $1 million single-family home. not enough to stop you from building 3,000 square feet on top of it.
I think this needs to be clarified more. I'm not sure what this $1,000 is referring to versus
that's
the
section C.
Right, I see it, but I don't understand what I mean. I would think the appraised value supersedes the $1,000.
And maybe that's what we're missing.
I think maybe that's it.
We don't understand what the appraised value.
Yeah.
It's a really fundamental thing I think people don't understand about bonds. Bonding is an insurance product. So you pay a premium for whatever the dollar amount is. If that bond is redeemed because you screw up, you get a bill from the insurance. It's not like other, like your homeowner's insurance where you pay your deductible next time. That contractor gets a bill saying, you get to pay us the bond company back for, because we've had to pay out on that bond. And it's going to make it harder for them to get it in the future. So there's a being able to continue doing business element when you require these bonds, even if they're small ones, because if they get to a point that they have had one too many of those come back, they're not going to be able to get a bond, and then they're going to have to put the money up in cash, usually. So there's a little bit more to that incentive than a small dollar amount that might be assigned to a smaller tree.
I appreciate that clarification, that I think we might want to change the wording in here, because what paragraph B talks about is a bond. However, one and two under C talk about
fine.
That's right. Yeah. So that's a big distinction.
Well, could the fine be the same as the appraised landscape value? You pay what the appraised landscape value is for. You pay that in a fine.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I think I found my heart for it. It's on page 21, paragraph designation of the just trees. In that
hold
period,
on. Can we finish this first? Thank you.
So that might be a solution, is just
appraised value.
Appraised value. So if, in this case, if you damaged, this tree was supposed to be retained, it's got a fence around it, looks all pretty now, but they tear down the fence, they damage the tree, you're talking $37,000.
I think that's incentive to be very careful with what activity is on that property.
Right. So I think you could almost, clarify this, clean it up, less words, and just say, you're either bonding for it, or if you damage it or remove it and you weren't supposed to, you are paying the city the plant appraisal value. Okay.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Can you say that?
Page 18.
Page 21. Designation of the trees. Into the detail of actually having native growth protection areas such as that established on private property, talks about it being recorded in the deed, going to King County. That, in my mind, does impact the private landowner by having protected trees, designated protected trees. Now, on my land, I'm fortunate to live on rivers, so I realize I have a duty to protect the trees inside the shoreline. The properties up slope that are not in floodway floodplain, if they were on a new lot under this code, I would have to always have all those trees documented on my deed and protected.
Well, not all, but all up to the value, up to the credit.
Well, the native growth protection easement, and just
for if they were bonded,
all the trees that were bonded are now moved into being recorded on the deed as a protected tree.
My suggestion for E would be to change it to native growth protection easements only. Native growth protection easements or critical areas, which we already have bonding for critical areas. That's where I feel like it should apply, and only in that case. And we do require native growth protection easements to be recorded anyways.
Are there any inside our city
But
yes.
you're not going to be building inside native crop protection.
Right. Right.
But we can give credit for those areas. Is that what?
For the tree credit? I think if you don't typically for what's there, I think if you added to it, you could get credit.
If
you plant to it, yes.
Why wouldn't we give credit for native growth protection use?
It's off-site.
It's off-site.
Well, if you buy that 5 or 10 acres and you have part of it as a protected easement, why wouldn't you?
You can use it for off-site replacement, it says, page 19. You can add to native growth, you know, and do off-site replacement. But I think in the beginning it talks about, you know, surveying for the trees, the minimum trees you need, and it exempts critical areas.
So what Dick was describing is where I kind of live. We have a native growth protection easement as part of our homeowners association that we cannot do anything with.
So does Forester Woods, for example. Yeah. Yep, same thing.
And so in this case, if somebody was to create a development like that, why wouldn't we give the developer credit for those trees? I'm not seeing why they wouldn't get any credit.
Didn't he already get it from density?
But
he had 10 acres and part of it was a protection. He's already given up land.
Mm-hmm.
And we gave him density for lots. Right?
Right.
So he's already got some
benefit. Right, and you're not double dipping them.
Typically, you know, most cities that I've worked with don't give tree unit credits for those areas. That's to try to keep some trees on the
site. Because you already have critical area requirements that say no net loss.
It's like
double
dipping.
Yeah.
I don't want to start a whole other conversation with that. However, therefore,
if we follow this credit concept, and I'm not familiar with it, this is kind of a first blush, I'm trying to tie it into development costs and the value of a credit. And if we stay on that as a way to basically save certain trees or increase the number of trees in a given plat, what if we say something in the code that says every building lot shall have X number of credits, so that the math at the end of the plat is there X number of credits throughout the plat.
Right. That's
so
what.
That's what it does.
That's what you
well,
get.
Well, but I just haven't read it.
Okay.
That way.
Yeah. The trees can be saved anywhere.
So give me an example then. Per credit, how many credits would a building lot need to have?
Let's see. An acre requires 44, and you said there's what, at least four or five lots per acre.
Mm-hmm. Four lots. Let's assume.
So would that be about 10 unit credits per lot. Okay?
But all of the credits might have been accrued on one
corner. On one corner. You can put them all on one corner.
Right. It's a land use type and it's a minimum credit per area. So wherever that area may be.
So back to my other point is, are the credits valuable enough? It's easy to get a credit, there's no value. If it's hard to get a credit, we're saving trees.
Mm-hmm.
I think something that has helped us in the past, especially because this is kind of a concept, you mentioned this has been applied elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any easily accessible, or do you have your own library of pictures of places where this has been applied, and so we can actually get a visualization of, you know, what we're talking about?
Well, we can give you the name of the city of Vancouver, Washington, has had it probably the longest. Dr. Lindy has had it.
For specific areas in there.
I'm sure we could figure out.
I think that would help kind of conceptualize these things. You know, obviously, I guess if people are using it, they're happy with it. It's like, okay, maybe there's more merit to it than what it sounds like, but people, a lot of us are visual people. And see it.
See how it's implemented.
Yeah.
In my mind, when I hear this discussion, I think we have a primary neighborhood. Sidewood States is a good example of a treed community, suburban community. under the street trees. Each lot seems to have a tree or two inside.
Is this old side view? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
When you drive, you look up that swale that goes through there with the overflow. That's a beautifully landscaped community. And I think when the council members talking about when they visualize, they would like to see that on every corner.
But that was flat when they built the house.
Right.
Yeah.
Those trees were planted.
Yeah,
so they all planted.
It's a mature neighborhood. Like those trees were planted at the time of construction. Mm-hmm. This is what it looks like 60 years later. Just like a lot of these other places will. The problem is, between now and then, we're going to look like downtown North Bend, unfortunately, without any trees. And that's kind of what I'm worried about, that I don't know if this hits. In 8 years, when I'm pushing up pansies, the trees are going to be gorgeous around here, but that doesn't do us very good around, in those 8 years.
I agree. That's the struggle. I don't think you can.
So you're pushing for larger trees to be viable or significant and not giving so much incentive or credit for smaller trees.
I think you give, if we're going to control or protect the trees, there needs to be a clear connect the dots path to money so the developer can make a decision based on financial circumstances, whether it makes sense to keep the tree or not. That's straightforward to me. And to be honest, I know, and you made a great point. You think about any neighborhood that's 25 years or older, and they planted street trees, and they planted some shrubbery in between the houses or whatever they did in the beginning, those neighborhoods feel really good versus what we've got right now, which is we scrubbed it all and hadn't had a chance to grow. On top of the fact that in the last 15 years we've decided to slam houses 4 feet apart. No place to grow anything between houses.
But even those new neighborhoods that feel really bare now, they're going to grow up and mature.
Right.
And the cottage development is adding in quite a few trees. And over time, those will get large next to the smaller cottage houses. And
so you give a lot of credit for big trees and require that they spend money. Ties back to the credit value to plant trees. Mm-hmm. And now you've got
a variety
of the big guys planting the new ones where they should go after the driveways and sidewalks are done. Right. They can actually thrive there rather than have a fence put around something that's not going to make it past the first playground exercise.
I love your idea, but here's where I pause. In your opening statement, you said something about the viability and trees that thrive. What's the, is there proof in that 40-year-old tree versus the one that's 6, 8 years old, 12 years old, I don't know, what withstands the construction traffic or, asphalt paving over or more interruption?
It's going to all be site-specific, I think. And some older trees are just that, and their life is diminishing. And some will carry on for
right. That's the dilemma of saving the large trees. I mean, it is favorable to save the larger trees, but like I said earlier, they're harder to protect because they're more susceptible to root damage, soil compaction, exposure to winds. They're the ones more likely to 5, 10 years down the road that you've left and a house is sitting there and a little old lady sitting there and not feeling good about this big tree sitting there. Whereas if you're saving or planting smaller trees that acclimate, that grow up on site, are acclimated to the conditions that they're growing in and the winds that they're exposed to, they're the ones that are more likely to be safe and last a long time and grow for a long time. That's why that neighborhood that you're talking about probably looks so good, because it has longevity of trees that have been there a long time, established, and most of them are probably safe. So that's why we're trying to provide a mix here. And the other thing I think you mentioned earlier about, it sounded like you preferred more trees around the site, more individual trees for more canopy. That is very good too. The problem with leaving large single trees, again, is that they're exposed, whereas if you were to leave groups of trees, they're stronger together and can retain more easily. So, that's the problem.
I would also, just kind of on that line of thinking, I would almost argue that the highest credit should go to a young adult tree.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and therefore the stand that that was in. I mean, I think you have to identify, like, what is our goal? Is our goal to retain the big old trees, or is it to retain, like, the natural, well, the natural vegetation? It's like you're saying, it's going to be far stronger in a, I don't know, 20 by 20 plot that has 4 to 6, you know, 6-inch trees, and there's more value in that, there's more viability in that than, you know, a 20-inch tree.
Well, that's actually one of the things that we did in this. The city of Kirkland actually has many more categories with more credits the bigger the tree gets, and we cut that off because we felt like you could develop a whole acre and meet the credits with one or two trees.
Yeah.
Which wasn't viable. So we backed it off and stopped the credits at, I think it was, what, 30 inch, 25 inches, 24 inches maybe. Figuring that, you know, we wanted those medium-sized trees that were more viable and able to retain those.
Live longer, too.
They live longer. So mm-hmm. these really big trees, they're really great, but, I mean, after you leave that big single tree and you have your million-dollar home sitting there, it's a little bit frightening.
So I don't know if anybody's driven by Tannerwood, but they have some cedar trees that are outside their fence line there that were planted with that development. And they're, I don't know, 14 feet tall right now, and they are full, and they look really nice, mm-hmm. and they shade the development. And so where I see, you know, these great big trees, and I have them around, my house was built in 1997, I've lived there since 2003. One has fell on my house. I've had a couple of dangerous ones cut down. My neighbor's house got hit twice by, you know, fallen trees. So we have all these trees that existed in our neighborhood. And so that's where I'm kind of listening to Jim, and I'm understanding, because this has been my reality, those trees that got left behind are not always going to weather the storms. And while there was minimal impact to the development, philosophy, there's still some trees that get damaged along the way.
Yes, I think Jim has provided a lot of excellent information, including thinning crowns. I think that those leaf trees, the first thing I would do would be to thin those crowns out, to take the wind sail out of them. Mm-hmm. Because that's what brings those trees out. They have this full crown,
mm-hmm.
and they're exposed. They grew up being trees all around, now they're exposed. They're very dangerous. They're very easy to come down. Thin the crowds out first before you even leave the project. So,
Jim, sort of a technical, I'm thinking about tree root balls, or mm-hmm. the drip line, the schematic you showed earlier.
Right.
It kind of depends. It could be boulders if working around.
Right.
But if you have a naturally grove of trees, naturally grown trees, their roots are intertwined.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
So if you kill the surrounding group of trees, does that undermine the soil when those roots actually die and degrade, that now the soil is loose so the roots of the tree that's surviving aren't strong? Does that work that way?
Well, it's sort of relative. The trees that are on the edge are going to be more impacted than the ones that are further inside the forested area.
Right.
That's why it's always difficult.
Using that one tree, there were trees around it before and now they're gone.
Well, not in this case. This was an old housing site.
Okay.
So this is all landscape. But in your scenario where it's a forested area, if you took some trees out, then others that would be left would be more stable. So you're talking about one of the problems we have whenever you have a solid forest, like a forest that is pretty much all the same, with, you know, similar size dead fir trees, let's say, and you want to take half that out, that exposed edge is going to be very vulnerable to failure. especially on the edge. The further you go in, they're not as vulnerable because, of course, they're protected, but also their root systems are not as damaged. So every site is different. And I've been on some sites where I've gone and assessed trees. This is happening in Mount Vernon because the soils there are very shallow. They're clay. The root systems are just flat as a pancake. I've said, you shouldn't save one tree on this whole site. You should take them all down and start all over. Because anything you leave, this really happened quite a bit at St. Paul. I started there like 20 years ago, and they were hoping to save a lot of trees. And they had trees falling everywhere. And they were near killing people. So they had to bite the bullet and take a lot of narrow buffers. We call them hideous trees. Narrow buffers out because they were falling. And we said, we're just going to have to plant trees up there. And that's why they really focused on planting better trees, providing better soil preparation and better soil volume for trees that they were planting rather than trying to save these narrow strips of trees.
Imagine if each building lot had a $3,000 requirement for planting trees. That's 3-4-inch trees, based on the other land. That sense of, after the new house was there, those three trees were visible along the street drive, that $3,000 investment would get us what we're thinking about, and our citizens are thinking about feeling like there's a neighborhood with trees in it, not little seedlings that nobody sees. This is a struggle. It's one hand, to me, it's really easy to developer to work around whatever we have in mind. They're going to play, they're in the moment, they're making decisions in the current set of facts. We're talking about the global scale from their perspective. If we want to save the trees, I don't think there's any other way than to make sure there's a value placed on the tree to protect it. And it can't be fuzzy math credits.
This is a 3-inch tree. This is a 3-inch tree. Mm-hmm. That's a very, very good size of a tree.
Yep.
That's about a 4-inch diameter tree. Breast height. The trees will be about 12 feet tall. Maybe 50. Not a small tree. But it's like Jim is saying, it's establishing. By the time it's 10 inches, it's going to be firm. It's going to be growing on sites. Much better tree than one. I agree. I think saving the medium trees are best route to go.
So, Curtis, your thought was to increase credits on the smaller trees. Jim, do we want to look at 4 to 8 inch or 8 to 12 inch? What do you think?
As far as raising credit?
Yeah, what do you feel is the largest but the most viable, I guess, specimen to keep? You said it's under 10 years old, or what you were saying?
Well, a 4 to 8 inch tree is probably, at least 10 to 15 years old. 10 to 20 years old, and you're only getting half a credit for that.
So would there be more value to those, sorry to interject, if they're in closer proximity? You know, let's say six of those within 15 to 20 feet, right? Because there you have an area that's protected. Say two of those grow to maturity.
And that's typically the case. Right. We're trying to save trees in groups because of the reason that I described earlier, so that their root systems and their critical root zones are overlapping, so you're not having to protect the same amount of area for each tree, because a lot of them are combining.
So how do we increase the value and incentive of that, while at the same time trying to find the balance of not making this such a...
So instead of giving credit for one, we give credit for a cluster of?
Maybe that would have more value. I don't know.
Yeah. It's already a priority for your design. You know,
to cluster?
To have clusters.
A cluster of trees provides wildlife benefits, too.
Right.
That's what we should find ways to give credits for that.
Right. It talks about that. That's on page 18. It lists all the priorities. Kind of goes down the line of that. And inherently, you're going to get more. If you have a cluster, you're going to get 0.5, 0.5, 0.5, you know, it multiplies.
The incentive to you is that you're reducing the total amount of critical roots on area you have to protect. Okay, if the more trees you have in a group, rather than an individual tree here and here, you're having to protect that area and this area. Whereas if you're having this, you're not having to protect
as much. So the incentive is built in already.
Yeah. Can we go back to the words, the wordsmithing that we were talking about, that maybe significant is not the right word, maybe viable is a better word?
We still should define significant because we use significant tree throughout the code. Do you know what I'm talking about? And so I don't know.
I'll have to do a search on that. If it shows up a lot of other places in 1910.
Yeah.
I thought it was 8 inches. I thought significant started at 8. Mm-hmm.
12 for deciduous and 15 for evergreen.
Say deciduous again?
Deciduous is 12.
Okay.
Real quick, I had a question on page 3. When we're talking about calipers, it's measured 6 inches above the ground for up to and including 4-inch caliper size and 12 inches above the ground for larger size. But then we're measuring trees at 24 inches above in another section.
For chest height.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm
yeah, there are like, two
at
different...
At what point do I, you know, it makes it very confusing. I don't know if we can simplify in the table that if you're... dimensions are from this to this, you measure at this distance, this to this.
Yeah.
One of the problems is we're combining landscape standards with forestry standards, because landscape standards talk about caliper and forestry standards talk about DBH, so that's where it's kind of an overlap.
Is there a preferred one that we should...
You know, if caliper doesn't show up otherwise in the chapter...
What we could say is caliper refers to landscape planted trees, whereas... retained trees is measured by DBH. Okay.
That is great. Okay. That gives me that clarity. Yeah. When we talk about development, and it says on number 11, which is unnumbered, unimproved real estate, but then we have some existing homes that we're redeveloping and we're putting 4, 8, or 16. Homes on there. So at what point do we talk about their 80-year-old oak tree or maple tree, like the one that's on North Bend Way or something? Mm-hmm. Where do we talk about redevelopment?
For their existing, if they have an existing lot with an exceptional tree on it. Mm-hmm. What we said was if they're not proposing development and they don't have an exceptional tree, they don't need a permit. So if they are proposing development and they have that exceptional tree, they have to comply.
But this is unimproved real estate. So I'm saying we don't have redevelopment or something. We just have...
Well, redevelopment is development.
Okay. Well, I don't... Maybe unimproved real estate should go away.
Okay.
Because then you can strike that, because if it's... Whether you're developing a blank lot or you're redeveloping... an existing lot, you have trees, and we want to save those, right?
So we just take out
if you have a shack, because whether you have a farmer shack or something,
mm-hmm.
Where does
do we want to in some way recognize the additional challenges that would be associated with saving an exceptional tree by providing additional credits? So if we have an exceptional tree,
mm-hmm.
do we want to recognize the additional challenges of preserving a tree like that? Because they typically are larger. They may not be placed in a helpful way by giving additional credits.
Well, one of the things we did, don't we give 1.5 times the credit for conifers? That's one,
yes.
That's one thing that is an incentive to. And most of the exceptional trees are conifers, aren't they?
We might run into some land in fruit trees that are mangers from early, assuming they're healthy from some of the early homesteads.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. In all cities, they handle this quite differently. Seattle has a really long list of what they call exceptional trees. Lake Forest Park has a list similar to this one. And you know, some just call out any tree over 30 inches is a landmark tree.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of different designations. You can go any direction that you want to go in. This our list here is a little bit limiting. It doesn't recognize those what I call pioneer trees.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a value to try and address that in some way.
And giving a tree density credit.
Right.
Okay.
You know, as we talk about some of the things that people have pointed out that we're losing the value, and I know it's hard sometimes as fruit trees kind of outlive themselves, but if we have some way to recognize that, we're not additional value, we can try to make it part of the value.
I hear you, and I understand what the public is saying. And then I listen to Jim, and the value in keeping some of those old trees is maybe not in the best keeping for what's being put on that lot. And
that is so one of the criteria, though.
Struggle.
Yeah, that it has to be,
Yeah, so if it's looked at,
it's going to be alive for a long time.
Rotting in the middle.
Right.
Obviously, yeah. It's not.
It wouldn't be exceptional, even if it meant the size of
right.
the species.
If it's defective, hazardous, then it wouldn't be.
So it's significant and viable.
Jim,
more exceptional.
Jim made reference to other code that has more. Are you thinking you want to see a 30-inch or just other than...
Oh, I don't know. I'm thinking specifically about... Because we do still have some of these random...
We have some old apple trees.
Yeah.
See, the problem with just establishing 30 inches is that a lot of those smaller maturing trees would never reach that.
Exactly.
Now, even a dogwood, like a native dogwood, mm-hmm. wouldn't
well,
reach 30
I, well,
inches. Sorry, but a 10-inch... Native dogwood is a significant tree.
Right.
So that's where Seattle makes it a little bit difficult, not difficult, but more detailed. They recognize a whole list of trees, number one, with certain sizes, and then they even add and say anything that's 75% or greater than a variety that's been listed in the Trees of Seattle book that Arthur Lee Jacobson has written is an exceptional tree. So you have to go through the book and find out. So that's where it gets really complicated.
But I'm just thinking that some way to recognize that.
So
it's not necessarily an easy thing to work on.
Are you asking on page 9-1 to list out what type of trees? Apple trees, anything else?
Should we say,
or just leave it open.
I was on a site not too long ago in Linwood where there was a big hickory tree. Mm-hmm. And the hickory trees, you don't see any of them.
I think you're going to maybe leave it to the qualified specialist to
maybe we just say a pioneer tree from a homestead or something like that.
I actually think pioneer tree fits a number of different ones. I like
conventional
because
tree.
It does kind of
homestead
trees,
pioneer trees, something like that. We can define it. We can define it. So
hold on. We could add a definition for pioneer tree and then put that on exceptional tree species table on page 9 with a
homestead.
Okay.
And then for threshold diameter, you could put based on arborist assessment or something.
Okay.
And then that covers it.
So I struggle with, the concept of protecting trees, great. You have these generic, or rather, overlay controls. But when you start talking about the specific apple tree that was great grandma planted, that concept, heritage tree, I'm struggling with the fact that in order to designate that tree that way, we're picking up the phone, we're calling the city, and we're saying, hey, would you send one of your surveyors out to mark this tree so it can't be taken down? That's kind of the landowner's choice. And not, if there's some protection for that, that probably
this is all on new
well,
sites.
And that's not where I was going with this. Where I was going with this is, can we give, if a developer has the opportunity to gesture or kind of sense of the ballot, that we give them additional credits for doing so. Not a requirement necessarily.
Yeah. A good example is that Maloney Grove site. It has a big oak tree on it, right, and it's right on the property line. So it would be easy to save without impacting the development of the site.
Well, so we'll use that example. Right now, if that tree, if the current owner decides to remove it, what happens?
Well, nothing right now.
They replant. Yeah, if they were to come in for a permit for a significant tree, then they replant.
Okay, if it happens to be damaged during development?
Then they replant. Not a lot more hammer farm.
No big fee, just replant.
Right.
Replant oak trees?
No, you could replant something else. Yeah. It'd be 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 ratio. It'd be
just to
small.
Put a wrap on the point you were saying, I'm familiar with several cases where a property owner sells their property with restrictions on title. Sometimes the restriction is, thou shall not remove grandma's tree. And it's there.
Recorded on the plat.
And that's a condition of title for whoever owns it out till forever, ad infinitum. So that, to me, that's much more appropriate for protecting the trees that don't quite fit. So, hey, let the people who own the tree decide what they want to do with it. And make it go to that step. It's not hard to do. As the next owner is willing to take that,
that wouldn't buy the property.
Well, that's the dance, right? Well, that's kind of what we're talking about doing here. We're saving trees and taking land away from the program. It's a dance.
So, sorry, Elizabeth, I got you correctly. You're not trying to add it to an exceptional tree. You're trying to create
incentivize
a credit
it
for
it as something they would save.
So
I'm not talking about the stick.
It would be correct,
there.
Right? It would be correct to say that we want to add a definition for pioneer tree and then add under table 1910.092-2 a credit for pioneer tree.
Homestead.
You don't want it under exceptional? Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Homestead.
You don't want it under exceptional? Or?
Do not.
So we
I misunderstood.
We want
just a definition and
the
then on page 15.
Yeah. How do you incentivize?
By giving them the tree credit for, by looking at the tree credit for saving trees at that time.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Well, I mean, it's, how would it be any better to save that tree than another native tree? How do we?
A hair more credit than another tree
yeah.
of that
okay.
size?
So, I mean, we can say, we could say 1.5, 1.25, I mean,
yeah.
times,
and
whatever.
And deciding what amount makes sense, I would leave to the group, that a little bit more than, you know, if it's a tree that fits that definition, they get a little bit more credit for it than
I'm still
than
extra credit.
Yeah,
extra
basically.
Credit. All right.
And I'm still struggling with how to get to understand the value of a credit. I mean, I can't get my head around what's that worth.
Maybe it's like Bitcoin, right?
Whatever
value you want. It's
blockchain.
You
this
need
thing, so pick
to
it
have
up.
10 on this site, right? So you can go about getting that 10 through all these different ways. Regardless of the way that you do it,
got
you
it.
Need 10.
Got that, but how easy is it to get 10? How hard is it
depends
to get 10?
Depends
on your site. You can save trees or you can plant trees. We require you to try to save 50%. You're supposed to save 50%. You have to have good reason not to. You can always come to the director and plead your case.
So is it your experience, Jim, that the way these credits are allocated, that it is sufficient for the developer to want to save the trees that we've been talking about?
It's usually easier, or it's more cost effective usually to save trees if they're in the right place on the site than to plant new trees. If they're on the right place. If they're not in the, if they're in the center of the lot, it's no good.
Right.
But if they're on the edges and the corners between lot
lines.
In a
park.
And on one site, what that credit might be, what you should mean it might be, is 37,000. Or it might be 2,500. Or it might that's going to change.
Well, I was coming back to my other point, too, because if that's the number we talked about earlier, we figured out it took about 3 trees to equal the value of a building lot, because that's the space, 60 feet wide, however the math gets worked out, whatever type of tree it is. So to me, that's where it ought to line up. It's like, are you adding another lot equivalent throughout the course of 20 lots? But how does the... It's fuzzy math to me. I get the concept, but it's like, so. Are we really protecting trees with enough value?
You don't necessarily always have to give up any lots to protect trees. If the trees are located in the right location, another example is Tanner, the Tanner site. When we were on the site, we asked about the grade of some of the, where the lots were laid out, and they said, it's at grade, there's not going to be any grading here. And there were some trees that were growing on the lot just at the edge, that most, or half the critical root zone was actually in the buffer area, the critical slope area. And like Mike asked, can we save those trees since they're on the back of the lot? It's not going to affect the layout of the lot, the
structure.
And they said, yeah, they probably could. So they were able to save more trees because it didn't impact the lot. If it's laid out that way, it's good.
So to use your example, they were on the buffer zone, these trees. So the value of credit for not taking the trees down is very low because they were going to leave them probably anyway.
They may or may not. I mean, another thing about this minimum credit is that you still have the option, the city has the option to talk or work with the developer to try to retain more trees than are required.
Than the minimum.
And that's the case of this Tanner site. They had plenty of trees they were saving in some areas, but they could save more trees.
I love about that, though. They were low on trees, weren't they? They needed more trees, right?
So, yeah, I think
I'm they weren't getting any credit. Yeah.
Yeah, they can get more credit by leaving these trees along the edge. So, yes, they were able to save more that way.
Am I making sense when I'm saying I can't quite grasp? Because that example, to me, the value of the credit for those trees is limited because they probably weren't going to take them down because they were outside the development.
They're still getting full credit, though.
Well, but...
If
they're getting full credit for trees they were going to leave, and they took out other trees they didn't...
But this is the old code, and they were under 15 inches, and they were just going to take them out because they weren't considered significant trees.
Okay.
But just because they're 14, they're almost identical to the 15-inch trees, but they weren't considered significant, so we just were ignoring it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It was just this, we happened to be out there walking each of the lots, and they said, can't you save some of these edge trees? And they said, yes, we probably could. So, more than so.
Okay.
Jim, just for my for our education further, how long has this concept been out there?
I can find that out, but I think the city of Vancouver, Washington has had it probably 10 years. Olympia, close to that. Kirkland, 6, 7. Yeah, it's been around for a while. And I've just had a conversation with another arborist about, I think Woodinville has a similar code to yours, and he had to go out to a site and he had to inventory 650 trees, and only a fraction of those are going to be saved. I mean, the developer had to go out and survey all those trees, first of all. Then the arborist had to go out and assess them, put them in a big matrix and figure out how many total trees there were, and then they saved 20 or 30% over in this corner site. So there's a lot of extra work for the developer. That's why, to me, it seems like it's a win for the developer and for the city.
Because you're avoiding the survey of all the trees.
Well, you're reducing the cost, and you're providing the incentive to save a broader range of trees in different areas. But every site isn't going to be fair. Some sites are just not going to work.
So,
I feel like I'm beating a dead horse, but I don't want to leave here not getting, like, I feel like I understand this. So, if, let's say you're talking to a developer who has this idea in his head that every one of these significant trees, 15 inches, 10 inches, whatever they are, every one of them is costing him some chunk of land, some a value assigned to a building lot. And his building lots are $300,000. Mm-hmm. And he's looking at 10 trees spread out throughout this project. How do we convince him that, hey, look, I'm going to give you enough credits here so it makes sense for you to save the trees? How do you explain that?
Well, no matter what, there would be tree retention requirements. So
let's back up on that.
The old or the new.
So the requirement, let's talk that through. So you've told me, okay, if you take all these trees out, there's going to be a requirement.
To replant, that you must maintain minimum 30%. In this case, we're telling him if he has 10, you can take 5. You can take 50% and replant those, and then approximately 5 under this scenario, and then let's look at your tree credits and how you get to that minimum that you need.
Let me back you up to the point. So if I, for whatever reason, decide it's my advantage as a developer, I'm going to wipe the slate clean.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying I've got a requirement to replant if I do that?
Yes.
Generally, idea, just give me some sense. Plant what?
For every tree you take, you need to plant 2-to-1 or 3-to-1. 2-to-1 would be a...
that's right now.
Right. A 4-foot, 2 4-foot Doug firs. 2 4-foot cedars. Or 3-to-1 is smaller. That's
and,
your...
And this revision would do what to that scenario?
This revision would require you, if you had 10 and they were large trees, you could possibly take 5. And not have to replant because you've met your tree credit minimum. If you haven't met your tree credit minimum, you might have to infill a few
trees.
But
you can plant trees. There's, you get a half a credit for every 2-inch or greater tree that you plant.
Yeah. So it depends on how many you have left and the size of them, but you might have to plant 0.
So I'm devil's advocate. I'm of the opinion that I should take them all out, because I don't want to have to think about working around them, and I want to be able to draw lines for sidewalks and sewer lines wherever I want to go really early on in the project. So my inclination is to wipe them all out. The question I have for you is, what's the penalty for me doing that?
Yeah, you're not going to be able to wipe them all out, but if you have a few large ones, you might be able to wipe out all the rest.
If I did, what's the penalty?
If you did, then we would go to the appraised value. If you would be paying that fee for the appraised value of the trees.
If a developer did that often enough, could they ever foresee getting a permit to build in the city again? I mean, that would be the penalty.
I'm a one-time guy. I'm on my way to Miami. I don't care. In fact, I just paid my guy cash to run the bulldozer around for 2 hours.
Right, it's hard. And then there could be an estate lot, and the person could know they're going to sell, and so they go take down their tree the year before, and they're a single-family homeowner. Now it's going to be developed. I mean, there's all kinds of ways.
It's another reason why we try to emphasize the importance of having the tree inventory first, of the viable trees, so that
the ones
exactly
you want to
save. Where they are, and we know credits are going to add up. I mean, it's an opportunity for the developer and the arborist to work together and figure out where the most viable trees are that can be saved. And then you work your lot lines, you work your roads or whatever. You know, just like on this site,
let's say we needed to save this tree to give us enough credits. Maybe we bump this wall out a little bit to save the root zone of that tree. It's a little bit of a deviation from a straight line, but if it saves the tree, then maybe it's worth it.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Are you looking forward to getting some action tonight?
Not a decision, no. Just some questions answered.
Right,
anything action for staff to research? Sorry, go ahead.
Right, so we have a number of amendments that we'll be making. Jim's not able to attend the next meeting. He's out of town. We will have a public hearing. Again, it doesn't mean you need to take action or we need to discuss it at length. We have a public hearing. So
That's the next meeting.
Right.
Mm-hmm. March 8th. So just real quick, everybody okay on time to go maybe another 15, 20, half hour?
We got about 20 in me.
Okay. All right, I'll try and go really quick. Page 8, tree hazard tree. Back on page 4, there's also a hazard tree. I'm just going to ask you to combine and simplify. There's a couple of those. Further down on line 16 on page 8, tree, multi-stem tree.
Okay.
Trees whose stems diverge below ground. How far below ground? Because, you know, I have some, what do you call, hemlock trees. And just 2 inches below the ground, they shoot up. So, you know, do I, how is that really a separate tree? I don't see that.
Yeah, this was from the original code, so yeah. I don't know. That's, you know, it's difficult to define Mother Nature, and it's a bit of a dilemma, I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you want to look at that, if it applies or not applies, or how you want to do that. I have an issue that it's a separate tree when it's 2 inches below the ground, and it's mm-hmm. sucking the same, mm-hmm. you know, life from that parent tree, or weakening it, I should say. On page 8, line 16, 17.
Okay.
Yes.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Number 36 on page 8, we talk about the viable tree, which means blah, 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 significant. Do you want to take a quick gander at that?
Mm-hmm.
No. Which makes sense.
Yes, it does. That's a good identification.
Okay, put that word significant in there again.
I know. Which.
So, by the way, what's a qualified professional?
That's
fine. Oh, brother.
I think that's defined somewhere, too.
I go to page 11. Point E, Jamie. Our most recent comprehensive plan was updated in 2011. This says 2009. I'm not sure if that should be updated or not.
Yeah, that will update itself when the ordinance is adopted.
I think I got that question answered.
On that same page,
yes.
I think that it's
Page number seven.
Yes.
Okay.
And it should be between 8 and 9.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'm off a page. That's why I was having to stop and think. I make notes that I can read. And read it from the version that you guys emailed me because I get it sooner.
When we were talking on page 15 for tree credits, we talk about significant trees, but we don't talk about exceptional trees there. And I'm just wondering, like on point 2, significant trees shall be, retention of all existing significant trees shall be required.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That to me doesn't seem... I don't know. But for sites where existing tree density is not sufficient. Okay, that's where you say if you only have 2 and you need 6, you have to keep the ones you have. Okay, I got it. Sorry.
Yep.
Yeah.
And we did talk about adding the homestead tree. And an exceptional tree. Give a correct tree credit for an exception. That's already mentioned in there if it's a fir, though.
Right.
Okay.
Do we want to give extra credit to exceptional trees in addition to evergreen trees and homestead trees at 1.5 times? Okay.
Okay. Exceptional and homestead. We're going to define homestead and give them both a 1.5.
Can I just not following any pages, just reflecting on in the last few years. Before we bring this to a vote, can we give this to a developer and ask them, like, this would be like a well-intentioned developer, ask them, what would you really do? Well, I think you provide a lot of that. I don't know. I don't want to play anybody, but
well-intentioned.
What would you really do with this piece? You know, so we could find the loopholes. Because I feel like this is something that we have worked on hard.
I'm sure we'll get comments. No, I'm sure we'll get comments, but what they were just talking about was the Sigalid property. I'm wondering, do you have a plan already for that piece of land that we could see how this implements?
Yeah. Or something smaller might be simpler.
Yes, something smaller would be easier to do.
Yeah.
We'll see.
It would just be nice before we get all gung-ho and feeling good about it, and then where you put it, you know, it gets put to the test.
Caught up.
Oh, man, not again. Totally. You know, blank to blank with that one.
Curtis, I'm just wondering, though, you know, from what we've seen in the development world, I'm not sure I get, if I perceive your fear, is the developer the right one that's going to give you the feedback?
They're going to have the perspective on how do I maximize everything that is important to me.
So you would say, here, how would you develop this lot based on these regulations?
How would you back, and then is this what we want? Or how do we tighten this up?
Okay. I'm going on to page 16.
The last minute steam.
Yeah.
Those are blue cherries.
Rock
and roll, man.
That was not what I was expecting.
You might have vodka in there.
Top of page 16, we talked about new development sites. And same thing, I might just say development site or however you determine that. So whether you have an existing structure or not, what we're trying to achieve is tree retention, right?
So what do you have a suggestion then of what you're looking? I guess our approach there was just to say it's only applying because you're a developed. Maybe we don't need new, just development sites.
Mm-hmm.
Because development's going to define.
Yeah.
Okay.
Chair, if I could, development, the threshold for development, is it a kitchen remodel?
Right. No, it's usually land disturbance related.
How do you really pour a new foundation?
Right.
With ADU? Your,
clearing.
What about an addition?
ADU?
Right.
Okay. So,
development
right.
On page 3?
Yep, we do.
Well, the reason I was going there is I'm thinking about most of the neighborhoods that have these wonderful trees on them, if they do anything, development inside, remodel work, they're probably going to run into our flood and have to deal with changing the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
So just, this could quickly turn into a, now we're talking about trees in the yard, in addition to their having to raise their house.
Well, it's if they're proposing an addition and on their floodplain lot, that would only come up if they're affecting their tree, too. So it's not just going to trigger it just because.
So they're not going to do a credit dance?
No.
Okay.
If there's no changes being proposed to the trees, there's no changes. They get their flood permit and be on their way.
Okay. But if they're dividing a lot and cutting down three of the trees.
Right. Or adding on so substantially that a tree has to be removed.
Okay.
Yeah. And if they already meet the minimum credit, they remove the tree, done. So don't even need a permit.
When we talk about supplemental tree location on page 19, you talked about earlier design standards where they talk about how to screen buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my only thought when we're listing out all these things, maybe we refer to other uses in design standards or something that we, so we're not duplicating, but we make reference to.
Yeah, where's your, at the top?
Yeah,
okay.
Number one.
Yes, we can just say set design, landscape plan consistent with XX. Yep.
My commercial favorite is Microsoft and Redmond, how they have native species planted, you know, in groups where they front their buildings, so they kind of screen them and go in and out. And it's just a really nice design, the way that I think we could mimic that for some of our warehouse structures and other businesses. Let's see. Preventive measures on page 21.
Where you get?
Yes. Where you at?
On page 19. Paragraph A3. That's the whole thing about in lieu of a replacement, a fee can be. See, that's the camel's nose out of the tent in my mind. I don't know why we, if we have this, we should somehow suggest that this would be a used rarely. This is a back door out for anybody who's looking for one. Present company excluded, of course.
Right.
Well, you can change it from director to counsel.
Something like that, yeah. It looks it's too much of a last resort.
Hold on, let Elizabeth finish her.
Yeah.
You're talking about last resort.
Right.
Yeah. Right. It just seems like it's too much like business like usual here. This is the thing that got us where we are.
It needs to be the director. It needs to be someone who professionally has an understanding of what's going on and doesn't inject variable politics in the process. So you may have mentioned council. It's a bit of a joke, but we for sure need to keep it.
Yeah, we can strengthen it up and toss that around a little bit, because I agree.
And maybe, I don't think we have the cost here. Maybe you make it high, like you were saying.
We were actually, so that would be in our taxes, rates, and fees. Maybe. Right now, it's $300, and we said at least $500, if not $750. So as part of these amendments, we would change the rate. To do fee and loop, and that would discourage even more. But we have really gone away from it as much as possible. There are some cases where you just, you know, there's the apartment project I'm working on, and they're putting hundreds of trees on the site. They've run out of space.
In the rare cases, this may be needed. This
yes. Yeah.
Make it sure that this is not exception.
Page 21, number 8, under preventive measures. The little bit of forestry knowledge I have, and Commissioner Ryan can correct me, maybe I'm off base here, but trees need space to grow, and there's always a proper spacing for a lot of different species. So what about being able to thin out trees? It seems like our code allows it under the credit system, but under preventative measures, I don't know, I guess, is thinning, Dick, is that pretty standard that somebody would do, whether you're an arborist or you're a landscaper, you're going to...
Yeah, Jim, I think Jim covered that. If you've got to tie and plant the trees, one of the best things you start off with is thinning out. That's the initial thing you do.
I think you bring up a good point, in that if there are too many trees too close together, you shouldn't get credit for all of them if half of them are suppressed by being so close, that some sort of best management practices should be implemented and recognized first before trees
selective thinning.
Because I have a really nice cedar, and then I have one that really doesn't have anything. Right. And it, I wouldn't think that's a viable one to keep. So, however that needs to be, I'll leave that to you. Then further down on designated of protection areas, I was thinking who maintains, I guess, the area? Does it have to have any signage, fencing?
Right.
What about hazardous trees that...
I think that's in here.
Right. I'm going to check this section, though, and see if it's... If it's overlapping with, because this is talking to native growth protection areas, and if it's overlapping what we already have in critical areas, maybe we don't need it here, or maybe we've overfought this section E.
Yeah, you're right. I think
it might be already addressed in another section.
This is what the overreach invite.
Right, this is the native growth protection areas or other designated protected areas, and that then there's a easement or something put on the plat and recorded. So if that's what that's addressing is native growth areas.
That's not part of this.
Right? Yeah, I'm trying to find it now. Where do they...
And the signage part?
No, the native growth.
It's on page 21, line 35. Is one place it shows up. I'll do a search if there's anywhere else.
It seems to me that if a landowner, this usually involves larger tracts of land, if they want to have a conservation easement on the property to protect vegetative wildlife.
Right.
And they can do that.
Right. Yeah. And we usually have done that through the plan. Yeah, we've done it through plat review. And
the city taking their police power and requiring the landowner to put this on their plat is overreaching in the extreme. I just can't imagine the city attorney, you know, writing letters to private landowners saying you must designate this tree as something horrible will befall you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not usually tree-specific.
No, how would a native growth protection easement come about in our city? Is it just specifically for a critical area, or would there be other?
Mostly critical area-related. The Tannerwood plat and the Tanner Falls plat have tree protection easements, I think they're called. And that's recorded with the plat, so it's not... And then it shows up on individual properties if it takes up a piece of the back of their property. But that was an agreement with a developer for a tree protection easement. Cedar Falls has some. And then native growth is usually tied to a critical area.
Okay.
And there's a lot of...
So the developer dedicated a piece of the plant he was developing.
Right. Or put it in an easement on backs of lots. Got, you know, tree credit. Maybe it was steep sloped.
But he donated that property. He didn't tie it to tract of land that he was trying to sell.
Right.
Right.
Well,
right.
It's not donated to the city, though. Yeah. It's donated to the
homeowners. Homeowners. Mm-hmm. A common tract, yeah.
I wouldn't accept it. I would not accept that. If I was an owner, I would not accept that. They wanted to give it to me, I wouldn't accept it.
Well, it's not even a donation, it's just in a recorded plat.
Mm-hmm.
It's just part of the plat development approval process.
Mm-hmm.
They never assigned a value to the land and said, here it is, it's yours. It was just approved like the rest of it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Gary, you said you have one too.
Yeah, the unfortunate thing is we can't like build a park or a swimming pool or tennis courts on it, you know. Has to stay
native.
Yeah, you can have a walking path, and that's about it.
forest management plan.
What are you doing in the case of like a nurse log, which is a down tree that can have a benefit to the community or to the environment?
Yeah.
Look cool or whatever you want to think, but that's a very specific.
Right. Usually you'll see those again in a native growth protection easement. If you can, you down a tree and you don't remove it. Mm-hmm. You keep it as native as you can. And you're only going to, if a tree starts to grow out of it that then becomes viable or significant or whatever you want to call it, you know, then it would be that, just that.
Right.
Yeah.
We had a tree that was leaning over Middle Fork Road, and so we had to go to the county for a permit and have a arborist come out and cut it down and relayed it back in the growth area where it is.
Okay. So I go to the bottom of page 27, number 3, significant trees that are saved in excess of those required to meet the minimum tree density shall not be subject to this section. However, shall be protected consistent with municipal code, tree production, construction, and new development. So, I'm wondering, so if I'm going to go beyond and save these extra trees, but I don't have any requirement to do so, is that basically what this line is saying?
Right.
And so I won't have a bond.
This would be assuming that the developer recognizes the value of saving trees on a site beyond what he absolutely needs to do to meet the credits. Because there is, you know, most of us know there are definite benefits for retaining trees, you know, environmental benefits, but even in some cases can increase the value of a lot. A lot of people like to buy a lot with a tree or trees next to them, so. Hopefully that would be the incentive for him to maybe protect and save more trees than he needs to.
I would think that paragraph 19.10.140 should really put the public on the ballot. I think that entire section is way out of the bounds of small town code. This whole thing is just violation of private property rights.
That has ordinance number, so is that something that went
the through? A is already in our code.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
No,
the rest of it.
BCB in here. That's new. And that this is also A is referring to any sort of clearing and grading activity. This is our clearing and grading section. So there are large bonds that we get when a site is going to go for development.
And the bonds are typically appropriate to the stage of development, right?
Right.
So there may be either multiple bonds or one that's drawn down on.
Right. A public works bond for all the improvements they did, you know, water, sewer, yep.
So once the plat is completed, if this language doesn't fit anything.
Well, like under A, you can hold bonds for a few years after.
It goes with the land, it doesn't read like it's tied into a development.
Well, the developer bought the bond, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wherever they financed it or whatever they did. So it's their bond. They're going to be coming after it to get it back. And they want to complete the project so they can get the bond back.
Yeah.
And this is relative, again, to clearing and grading. So that phase of development.
My last one is on page 29.
Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Just on this one that we still have, we're completely bold. If we're going to increase the burden of the landowner by saving trees in excess of the minimum by, tell me if I'm reading this right or wrong. Are we like increasing the liability or the amount that it might cost them to maintain those trees with this wording? Because in that case, what you were saying, that we hope that they realize the inherent value,
right.
That's what we've lost. Because if, well, now it's going to cost me more if I have trees in excess.
No, it's so saying that if they save in excess, they're not subject
to
the okay. rest
the
of
bonding
the bonding. And yeah.
Okay, that's what I thought it sounded. I just wanted to make sure that would create the reverse.
Which right. is probably what they would think, and then we can point them to that line that says, no, you're not. Which is a good thing to happen.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. Farming and agriculture uses on page 29, it's new number 10. And after the comma on line 30, it says, however, no significant tree may be removed under this categorical exception, exemption. When we say no significant tree, that means no 4-inch tree can be removed. And if I'm farming, that's where I say we use significant tree in a couple places where it doesn't fit. Here's one example.
Good call.
So we need to find we need to write this as we mean it, what type of tree we don't want removed from farming practices. Who else has any other questions or thoughts that we need to convey? I heard, Curtis, you were asking for some pictures of how this looks.
Maybe to take a site and a scenario and show the difference between the present code versus the new code and how it might apply.
Yes,
something like that.
Yeah,
we can figure something out.
Okay.
I'd add another comment to that as some way to give us some understanding of the value of credit. I mean, I get that we're requiring somebody to give us some credits, but the developer is going to be saying, what's it cost me? And that's the piece I don't understand.
So if we're asking them to plant, like, say, a 4-inch cedar tree, how much does that cost, you know, in order to get that 4-credit number that they violated? Is that kind of where you're going?
So
or do you want, like, how we would appraise the tree that they cut down? So that's, I'm just trying to...
I get the math is always going to be fuzzy, but I'm concerned that we're going to draw this wonderful thing that we think is enough credits, because we require credits for the plat, but if the credits don't turn out to have any real significant financial value, it's just a nice thing to talk about. If it's easy to work around, it's easy to get the credits, what are we doing? That's kind of where I'm at.
So what I was thinking along your lines, that's my work, is to go figure out how much a 4-inch cedar and Doug fir and, you know, type tree will run me, and then if I have that option as a developer to plan my street or sidewalk as I want, is that acceptable or not? And what you're saying is, unless it hurts, then that's going to be always the option.
It needs to make financial sense.
You said, and Jim knows those off the top of his head, I think, so to plant an 8-foot conifer?
An 8-foot conifer or a 2-inch caliper
decision is about 1,000?
It depends on the right. soils, and it depends on
even
a lot
range.
Of things. It's $500 to $1,000.
Okay.
I mean,
should we have a minimum in there, like if trees cannot be below a certain diameter? Because I'm thinking the loophole here is, oh, I'll go buy a bunch of, you know, cheap little trees for $60. Is that
2-inch.
Okay.
It says 2-inch caliper. We're using the.
But I don't know what that means.
This is about a 2.5 inch caliper. And that's measured. Caliper is the diameter.
Our new street trees are 2-inch, aren't they?
That's also a problem too, right?
Yeah, there's a little bit of tree shortage right now, believe it or not. Of certain varieties that you wanted downtown. So.
But if they have 4-inch trees on their lot, they could just power wash the roots and ball them up and move them, right? I read that in here or something.
Well, you could transplant them.
Are they air blast them or something?
I think it says they're not getting credit.
May have got corrected on the print version versus the but it would be on page 6 where we have the definitions. Tree critical root zone is the first one that I noticed where they're not all numbered.
Yes, right. I did that kind of on purpose because if we were going to continue to add numbers.
The editing was just right. Being really crazy.
Right.
DBH and DSH have been interchanged now throughout the mm-hmm. hasn't made the transition to DBH.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Yes, Jim. Thank you very much for all the information. Anything for good of the order?
Yeah. I have one thing just to have you guys think about at the next meeting. We'll be voting on the new chair and vice chair for the coming year, and many of your terms expire. So if you think you may not be renewing terms, we know we're at least going to need to fill one position. Let me know. Shoot me an email. Because it takes some time to fill these. You and Scott are here until 2019, May of 2019. The rest of you are discharged.
If you, the same time, right?
It's May 18th. Yeah.
There's only two left standing.
Yes. So, yeah. If you already know, let me know. If you're thinking you're not wanting to continue, because like I said, we'll go ahead and advertise, and it takes a little bit of time.
I have sabbatical plans.
Well, and coming back, that's what that means. Leaving, but coming.
For the immediate next probably 6 months to a year.
Okay.
If you need to fill the slot.
Okay. 6 months to a year, starting when?
I wasn't expecting to be here to play it out here right this second, but I don't want to leave us in a jam.
Okay.
I kind of called this out 6 months ago. The guys were all getting out at the same time, so let's talk about it.
Okay.
Aren't you glad you asked? We've met with somebody. At the last meeting, we met somebody outside that was talking about it. I hope you've got several people talking about it.
There is actually one for sure that's interested.
All
right.
Seeing none, I will be for the beginning. And then I am off to a strategy session. Who is having meetings on the same night now. It has been an honor.
That has been my honor to sit with you. You're on that wall.
All right, two left or two's by in the first round.
Okay.
Motion to adjourn.
Yeah, motion by Commissioner Von Trapp. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Commissioner Lucky. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
The commission is adjourned. It is 9:35.